So for my skill in that portion, I ate a taco. And then I also had my staff bring up a bunch of bags of tacos and I started tossing them out in the crowd.
Wait, your skill was eating the taco?
Yes. My side hobby, he was like...
That's awesome, dude.
Thanks for joining us for another exciting episode of The First Podcast. My name is Joe. I'm going to be your co-host today. With me, as always, we have Lars.
Arrivederci.
And we have the shadow of the podcast as well, Chris, joining us. Say hi, Chris.
Hey, everyone. How's it going?
Welcome to the show, Chris.
And a special guest, we have Sam Jamal joining us. Sam, tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do.
Hi. Thanks for having me, guys. I'm Sam Jamal. I live out here in Fullerton, and Joe and I connected when I ran for Congress, actually, this past year in the 39th Congressional District. I'm an attorney, and I work in clean energy, and that's where I've been spending the last few years of my career, and have been active in politics for several years now, and then decided to take the jump back in 2017 to try and make sure we turn this region blue.
So you sort of touched on a few different subjects. Your run for Congress, that must have been exciting. When did you first decide that you wanted to run for Congress?
Well, it was really last spring. My fiance and I, just seeing everything in the news with the Trump administration, just being concerned about the direction of the country, gave it a lot of thought. And where I grew up, the 39th District didn't have like a deep bench of Democrats running. And so, decided, one, there's an opportunity there to help make a difference. And two, we need new voices in politics and just to be engaged. And, I'm a millennial, I'm 36, and want to make sure that there's younger voices involved in the process, because I think a lot of the challenges we face as a country really are going to affect our generation the most. And so that's what kind of drove me to jump in and take the plunge.
Well, and this country needs more younger people like you to sort of step up and be the representation that you want to see. I do remember when you're talking about last spring, after Ed Royce announced that he was not going to be running for re-election for the 39th district, there was sort of among Democrats, I feel, and probably Republicans also, this feeling like, oh, who's going to run? Who's it going to be? And you're right. There wasn't a lot of options. There weren't a lot of options at the time. We did get a few people who stepped up.
By the way, I did notice you mentioned being a millennial at 36, and I think we've talked a couple times on this show about how millennials are actually starting to get older, and there's this kind of misperception of people in that age bracket as being young and just starting or just out of college, and they're just stupid and they don't know anything. And all they want is free stuff. But really, what's happening now is, millennials are well into their 30s at this point in a lot of cases, and they have kids, they have wives, they have houses and mortgages and cars and dogs, and they've advanced to a certain point in life. So I think having more representation of that age bracket in Congress is a good idea. I applaud people running for that. So I'm thankful that you took the plunge.
No, thank you. And I think that's probably the most common misconception is, where our generation is like age-wise. And that leads to just dismissing a lot of views and opinions that, we're the largest voting bloc in the country if we choose to exercise that right. And we're also the ones most affected by a lot of the, undertones and where the economy is going.
I was hoping we could go into some of the challenges of running for Congress or some things that people wouldn't normally.
Oh, yeah. You have a unique perspective here.
Very unique perspective. Yeah.
Can you? I know that this is kind of vague, but what was it like? Because most of us won't go through that.
Oh, no. It was definitely a crazy experience. So when I got in, actually, it was in July of 17. And Ed Royce is still the congressman, though there was some thought maybe he might retire. And I knew I'd be in a crowded primary. And so, starting a campaign from scratch is a challenge. It's you're essentially at a startup where you're also not just the CEO and CFO and COO, you're the product. And so it's a very weird experience because in that early stage especially, you're calling through friends and family and professional acquaintances to try and, you know, raise the funds to get the campaign off the ground. And to a large degree, what you're trying to do is raise funds to be able to go to some of the larger institutional donors and say, hey, I've got a message here and we have resources to be able to get our message out. Can you help? And so I think that was, you know, a challenge. I think, you know, being on the younger side, I think the difference is like, you know, I was 35 at the time. You're 35. Most of your friends are just starting families at this point. You know, a lot of friends that are having kids the past 2 years or gotten married the past few years. And so they're not necessarily the big check writers in a sense, where if you're running and you're 50 to 60 years old, you have friends who are their kids, you know, they're empty nesters. There's a little more disposable income. And so I think number one, that was probably the biggest challenge in like, you know, I grew up in a working class household. So it wasn't like because of my student loans, I can just cut myself some huge check and just run a campaign off of that. I had to rely on $5, $10, $2,500 donations to just be able to get things going. So I think that was a challenge because you have to call more people and do double the work to get it off the ground. The second part of it, too, was, you know, I was still working the first 6 months of the campaign because I needed to make sure I had healthcare and also needed to make sure I had some income, where my fiance and I had budgeted the last 6 months of the primary, basically in January through June. I would just rely on some of the stock that I was able to earn when I was working in the solar industry, as well as just different savings and stuff like that, and kind of pinch pennies to get there. So I think just there is an inherent, like, you're working a day job and then you're also running a 40 to 60 hour week campaign. And so just the degree of work that goes into it and the long days and, you know, some days are, you're literally on the phone raising money. Other days you get the benefit of actually going and talking to a ton of voters, which I always found to be the best part about the experience. And then also because, you know, congressional races until they get past the primary generally are run as mom and pop operations. So, you know, the candidate's very hands-on in a lot of aspects of it. And so in those early stages, I was drafting everything and putting out everything and, you know, had my fingerprints on all aspects of the campaign in addition also just being out there as the candidate. And so, you know, on one end, it's exciting because you have to be creative. On the other end, you know, it's a tiring process and you have to make sure you want to be in there and try have a real purpose to make a difference.
I think that there's something going on when it comes to running for an office, which a lot of people kind of forget about, which is that it's not usually a situation where you just say, oh, I'm going to run for Congress. I'm going to be able to take 6 months off just go do that full time. And, you know, not everyone has a small loan of $1 million like Donald Trump. And it can be tricky, I imagine, being able to fund that. So I imagine there's probably some actual institutional issues where the kind of people who can actually run are probably in a lot of cases going to be fairly privileged. So I think it's great that you were able to gather up the funds for that to at least run for it. But I imagine it was probably difficult going up against some of the titans, some of the bigger guys.
I think that was probably the biggest hurdle of, you know, being a younger candidate, there are limitations on just where you are in life.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, you know, I don't have a trust fund,
yeah.
or anything of that nature that would underwrite this whole thing. And so that made it also just as uniquely challenging. At the same time, though, you know, people do this every now and then, not enough. And I think that's one of the barriers to getting young people to run, because it is saying, okay, you got to freeze your student loan payments. Mm-hmm. You've got to freeze whatever other things you're planning on doing to get your life, you know, off the ground still, because you're on the younger side. And you got to do it for, in some cases, 6 months to a year, if not longer, if you make it past the primary. And so, you know, it comes with its own unique hurdles. I think that's why it makes it a challenge to make sure our representatives understand what, you know, folks are really going through when, you know, they're concerned about politics or even thinking about politics at all. And, you know, in my race, we had a lot of very wealthy folks that were running who were self-funding. And so it kind of made it even more of a unique challenge. At the same time, you know, I think what I really enjoyed about the process was you start talking to other folks on the ground and, you know, they see like, okay, if that guy's going for it, then I can go for it. And so I know a lot of people are running for local races, school board, city council in various cities, because they were like, you know, my whole goal in the process also, I mean, you know, I worked in politics in some senior roles. And so very well aware of the process. And part of my goal was, you know, one, to win, but two, to hopefully engage other folks to step up and get involved in the process too, because we just need more voices up there and new voices. It's not even a matter of one party versus the other. It's just, we need to kind of turn the page and actually start tackling some of the challenges that are going on today. And so for me, that was like, when I was always tell folks, like, step up and run, because if you're not running, then someone else is. And we need to make sure the voices are a little more reflective of, you know, everyday people.
Yeah. So it's like, so kind of what you're saying is it was about winning, but it was also not about winning. You wanted to run kind of both as a serious candidate, but also as kind of a symbol to other people, maybe as an inspiration of some sort. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. No, definitely try to set a good example, throughout the race and try to run a positive campaign because of that.
Yeah.
To make sure that, you know, having, you know, I was a chief of staff in the House of Representatives, and you just see that there's just not enough regular folks engaged in the process.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's how we got to this point of Donald Trump, like, where DC just feels very distant to people and doesn't feel as responsive. And what that led to is just a lot of division out there and a lot of issues not being resolved. And, you know, the only way to get that back is by getting people back engaged and believing in the process.
Well, I have a question. So going back to July 2017, you were starting your congressional run, but you were not yet sure if Ed Royce would be retiring. When he announced he would be retiring, was that more of a relief that you wouldn't have to be running against him, or not a relief? And in fact, the opposite?
It was the craziest day of a very unique campaign, because on one hand, I was getting phone call. You know, when I jumped in, I had a lot of folks tell me this is a little bit of a fool's errand, because Ed Royce has been there for 24 years. He has $3 million in the bank. He's not going to retire. And, you know, you get out of this primary, you're going to get crushed by this guy because he's a known commodity. And my whole thing was, I think the environment's changing. I think the district's changing. And I'm not sure if this guy actually stays in the race.
Mm-mm.
And so I was always initially having to essentially not just pitch myself, but pitch the concept that this is a winnable seat. When I was reaching out to donors and just different political folks to pay attention to the race. And the day that he retired, I got a lot of calls and text messages being like, what did I know in advance? Mm-hmm. Because, you know, how did I call that one?
What made you think that he would be retiring? Like, what gave you a feeling?
Well, the fact that Hillary won the district didn't necessarily mean to me the district is instantly flippable, but it meant that this guy who had essentially had easy races throughout his career was going to start having tougher races. And he's 66 years old, was terming out of his committee chairmanship, had been there 24 years, and had stopped being in the district for like 7 years since his last town hall. And so it kind of made me think, is it worth it for this guy to go through? Because no matter who made it out of the Democratic side, even if Royce was going to win, and I don't think that was guaranteed, he was going to be in a tough race and his entire brand was going to be challenged, where he could otherwise just ride off into the sunset, not have to answer for Donald Trump, get to leave as former committee chairman Ed Royce. And so I kind of felt the human side of things on this, where I think for a lot of folks, if you were given all those facts, you would think, well, maybe I'm going to do something else now. And so I kind of had that sense that that was a possibility. And so the day of, it was initially, you know, an infusion of resources and a lot of energy and excitement for my team. And then I think over time, it also became a little bit of made the race a lot tougher, because, you know, going into a race where you're going to be in a competitive primary to face an incumbent is a lot different than running in an open congressional seat, where we ended up with, I think, 17 people on the ballot. And the Republicans had a competitive group of folks, and ours was competitive and a lot of folks in. And because of California's top two system, there was some anxiety about making sure a Democrat makes the top two, which it created a lot of narratives in the campaign that made it a little more challenging. And so in some ways it was like, it was great he stepped aside because it made the district a real seat that people thought can flip. At the same time, it also just changed the dynamics of the race in ways that we didn't totally expect. And also just added more people to the ballot that made it hard to, you know, stand out. And so it kind of just, it just changed the nature of things in both good ways and bad ways. It was, it also made the race accelerate from, you know, you're going 90 miles per hour, 100 miles per hour several days a week to 110, 120 miles per hour where, you know, I, as I mentioned, I was working at a job about 30 hours a week through December. And then once Royce announced his retirement in early January, I fully became a full-time candidate because just the speed of the primary was just a different level.
So, Sam, just out of curiosity, just to change the subject very slightly, say you had won, what would be some of the, maybe a good, maybe 3 to 5 key priorities for you?
Big issues for me, I mean, climate change and the environment are huge. I mean, you know, they had the recent report from the UN, and we've got 12 years or so until we start to see further temperature changes. I think we need to tackle it head on, not just from a, hey, we got to stop climate change, but how can we use this as an opportunity to create clean energy jobs? It's a passion of mine. And I think there needs to be that focus because it ties into another issue of the nature of work is just changing. You know, you have automation coming down the pike and already starting in a lot of different fields. We have a much more global economy, so jobs are just different. And you do have a lot of Americans who are struggling where, you know, you're doing a lot of work and making less than you did before. And so, you know, I see the opportunity to build like clean energy jobs tying into that aspect of we need to create that next phase of jobs for Americans. And, you know, that's a hurdle that really has to be focused on because even as the economic numbers look good right now, the bottom line is we're seeing transitions in where our economy is going. And then that ties on to, I guess, what would be a third set of priorities is just the cost of living issue.
Oh, yeah. That's
you know, whether
one.
You're talking about healthcare costs or student debt or the cost of housing, it ties all into the same bucket of, you know, the cost of living is very, it's increasing in California. It's increasing all over the country.
Especially in California, it's enormous already.
Oh, yeah. And it's making it hard for younger families to get started. I mean, we're a generation where home ownership rates, I believe, are the lowest since before World War II.
Yeah, I can't afford a house right now. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's just, there's just a lot of economic anxiety out there, even if on the surface people are like, okay, well, I got a job, I'm okay. But, you know, you're not saving money. We're at risk of losing entrepreneurship in that sense, mm-hmm. too, of, if it's just harder for folks to just set aside some money to be able to start that small business. And so I think to me, that's like an underlying issue that bubbles up in every aspect of what's going on today is there's just a lot more anxiety out there on where people stand versus prior generations.
Yeah, it's troubling times indeed. I do have a related question for you, and I'll tell you why I'm asking it after, but I'm just curious. Do you believe in climate change, global warming?
I do. I believe in science.
See, that's really good. And it's, but I also feel like it's kind of sad that, like, I feel like I have to praise someone for that because it seems like there's just like this huge distrust of the fact that the environment's going down the drain right now. And people are fighting tooth and nail to avoid confronting the facts and truth of the matter. And, I don't know what's going on with that, but
why do you think that is, Sam? Why do you think there's so many people denying climate change? What is the ulterior motive?
You know, the fossil fuel companies have a lot of influence on our politics, yeah. And a lot of it comes down to just money and politics. I think there's also an adjacent aspect of if you're, you know, an older generation per se, like an older politician or an older CEO of like Exxon or something, you know, you're kind of trying to get to that last mile to retire and things like that. And an issue like climate change requires some degree of restructuring and rethinking of priorities.
Oh, no.
Yep.
And so I think some of this comes down to obviously the money and politics side, but also a desire, a lack of desire to have to lead in that conversation. And so, you know, you have some folks where it's like, you know, I'm on my way out the door here. I don't want to have to deal with this complicated issue. I'm just going to say it's not real. I think you do have other folks, though, too, who it's just straight up, those are their campaign supporters. And then a third bucket of, even if I think this is real, I don't want to admit it because the political camps have so polarized around this. And so when I was working in the solar industry, one of the things I used to have to do was present before different organizations all across the political spectrum. I'd meet with the environmental groups, the Sierra Club, League Conservation Voters, and like on Monday in San Francisco. And then I'd fly to Vegas and meet with the NAACP on Tuesday. And then by Thursday, I was in DC meeting with like conservative groups, national security groups, the Christian Coalition, different folks. And so you're having different conversations on clean energy. And I would try to avoid just talking about it from a climate change concept across the board because they all have different priorities. And when I would meet with a lot of these conservative folks, you know, a lot of them, they did believe in climate change. They're just not going to wear it on their sleeve. And it's just trying to find ways that help them make the broader persuasive case that, you know, we can build an economy that has 100% renewable energy powered or electrified transit or transportation. Like, we can do this. The technology's here. Let's focus on the innovation side, as opposed to trying to have people go out on the ledge a little bit from their political camp and, you know, state what we may believe is obvious. And so I think some of it's a little bit of that too, which is unfortunate. But that's where it's like you have to find people who are going to be consensus builders on these issues and kind of paint the roadmap of where we can go.
I'm not a politician, but I am quite the activist. And the way that I tend to frame it, if I feel like I'm getting resistance from people, is I try to explain it like, whether you believe in climate change or not, we should probably be acting in a way as if it did, because either way, the environment is suffering. So we probably need to adopt more environmentally friendly policies. So I think, yeah, you're right. It's probably less about trying to convince people of something that's very perhaps partisan in some ways, and also being fed to people on the right in particular as a lie, which it's not, but maybe moving away from that and moving towards just trying to get the actual policies in question in office. So, or in action. I think that's a good approach.
Yeah, I mean, I'd even give an example. So I'm working with a lot of right now on, you know, clean buses and clean transit, like electric vehicles.
What are you up to right now, now that the congressional race is over?
So I'm working on with a clean energy company, helping, and they're in the electric bus and electric truck space, helping them with their market development and policy work. And so the thing with that space, it's interesting because even as the Trump administration's been, you know, pretty awful in terms of their perspectives on climate and really pushing a lot of fossil fuel priorities, they haven't cut funding to allow like transit systems, like local transit authorities, to start to electrify their fleets. They've kept some programs in place, and some of that has to do with just the economics of it. And some of it's also, you know, where we can, you have to build bipartisan consensus to let folks know that, okay, well, these, if we're not going to shoot bigger picture, at least create the opportunity for states and local communities to take the lead on these issues. And you know, my hope is, 2 years from now, we'll have a different president, and we'll have the opportunity with that new administration to have a bunch of different examples from all across the country on how states have started transition to cleaner energy and started really taking the lead on the environment, that then you can create a more of a framework on the federal level that can support that, where, you know, the silver lining of Trump is like, it's forcing us to do the work on the ground.
The silver lining of Trump, that's a, wow, that's a quite a statement.
The other silver lining of Trump, which you kind of touched on a little bit just now, is that in 2 years, hopefully we do have a new president, and you've got all these people who have ran for...
I sure as hell is going to vote for a different president, by the way. Like,
yeah.
If I had my way, I would definitely have someone else in there.
Hopefully in 2 years we have a new president, and also we have all of the old timers in Congress who are out of touch, out of office, with a bunch of new people in office, like, you know, people like you, Sam, who have like a vision of just a better America. that's rooted in science. And these are people who would never have ran if it wasn't for Trump.
I agree. I mean, I think one of the things that you see on the ground, there are just so many more people running for city councils, school boards, state legislatures that really would have never ran had Trump not won. And so just the quality of candidates has improved. And, you know, I've been working on campaigns for a while, and you just see the quality of candidates that are running. It's just a higher quality. And so I think what he did was he forced a lot of folks to realize, I've got to pay attention and I've got to put myself out there and see how I can contribute to my community, whether it's running for Congress or whether it's getting engaged just generally politically. Because even among the activists that, you have people bringing in skills that maybe they were just focusing on just for their private business, where now they're offering that creativity or different skill sets to help, you know, hone messaging on this stuff. And so I think that's where, when you look across the country, just the quality of campaigns and quality of candidates is something we've never seen before in my lifetime. And I think it's, I don't think it's just going to stop now after this election. I think what people realize is, like, if you don't engage yourself, then you do have a situation where you can have someone like a Trump in there, or have a Congress that, you know, really has just been sitting on the sidelines in a whole host of issues for a while. And that's not even just being partisan. That's just, you know, we have all these big challenges and we just keep kicking the can down the road. I mean, even locally, that's the same problem.
Yeah, I noticed, I don't know if you've ever seen this movie, but in American Psycho, Patrick Bateman actually has kind of a insincere speech at one point. And this was supposed to represent the 80s, in which he listed off a bunch of political issues that at the time they were relevant. But it's interesting to watch that movie now, because in 2018, a lot of the things he was talking about, like, you know, solving issues with racism and just, you know, social inequalities and stuff, we definitely have kicked the can down the road considerably for several decades now on some of those key issues. And I think that having, you know, people like you, you know, the Sam Jamols in the abstract, who are younger with fresh perspectives, starting to run, starting to get inspired to run, is really healthy for the country. So we can actually stop kicking the can on some of those things. I look forward to seeing what happens in this election and the next one, see kind of where that goes.
Yeah, I think we might look back 5 years from now and start to be able to point out that a lot of key conversations started to happen and people started to do things. I mean, just using an example in Orange County, the homeless crisis, like, in years past, the Board of Supervisors could have just done nothing on the issue and closed down, you know, the shelters that were right by Angel Stadium and gotten away with it, and no one would report it, no one would have discussed it. But because Trump made people a lot more aware of things that are going on around them in politics, there was a huge pushback, and, you know, they've suffered some losses in court, and everyone who's running for office up and down the ticket is having to actually answer questions on what they're going to do about homelessness, where for years we were letting that crisis essentially just fester. And, you know, it changes things.
By the way, Sam, I've noticed something, and that is, you seem to bring Trump's name up a lot, and it not in a favorable light. I get the impression that you don't really like the guy.
Just
a hunch.
Not a huge fan. Not a huge fan. I think
we are not huge fans of him either.
Yeah.
So
I do think that he represents a little more of a symptom of a lot of broken aspects of things, though.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's always like a useful reminder that he's doing what he's doing, but he can only get away with it if we don't pay attention. And in a lot of ways, a lot of the day-to-day stuff that has to be worked on and fixed, like, it goes well beyond Donald Trump. And so, but if you can use the megaphone that he creates, in the sense that people are now paying more attention to politics, to use that attention span to start to focus on some of these other issues like housing, homelessness, cost of education, or other things, you know, I think it's useful, because, you know, I'm someone, you just organize your background in the sense of, you got to use whatever forums you have and venues to just start to push the ball forward on different issues. And so even where I'm not a fan of him on the policies, I also see, you know, he is a vehicle that we can hopefully start to solve some problems, in the sense that we're actually getting more people paying attention now than we did before.
Yeah, negative motivation. Yeah. I can see that. Joe, you had a question?
Well, Sam, you brought up something very interesting that I haven't really heard before, but it makes a lot of sense, which is that you've got these CEOs of oil companies that are looking to retire very shortly, and they don't want to change the structure of the company because they're retiring. So is it, would you say it's a catch-22 because in order to become a CEO of a large company like that, you have to have a lot of experience? And once you've got that large amount of experience, you're now close to retirement and you're not going to want to change the structure. And would you say that we need more young people as CEOs, even though they've got maybe less experience, because they're going to maybe be more willing to change the structure?
I think it'd be helpful to make sure that like the leadership of companies does have like a broader reflection of, in a sense, experience and age diversity, and that, you know, the reality is like battery storage is a perfect example. It's going to be a huge part of our energy portfolio. It's going to be a huge part of our energy system. And instead of really honing in and focusing on how do we create a battery storage economy here, we just have Tesla and maybe a couple other smaller companies. But most of the bigger companies that actually would have the resources to really drive and lead on this, they're not. And it's largely because what's the appetite for stepping into a new realm of innovation if you're already doing okay on your stock shares to date on your, you know, more fossil fuel portfolio? Why add another thing in there when it's a little more long term, even if it's going to be a huge part of the economy, because there is the risk of like disruption and socializing change among your, you know, cohorts. And, you know, a lot of folks just don't have the appetite for that. And so, you know, I think it's like you end up having a mix and match to some extent is the ideal, because, you know, we're falling behind on a lot of this. You look at like electric vehicles, what's going on right now globally, you know, there are more foreign manufacturers leading the way in electric vehicles than U.S. companies. And what that's risks doing is, you know, that has an effect on our economy. And so, you know, we do need disruptors that are startups and newer companies to enter the market, but we also need some of the old guard companies to make sure that they're nimble enough in a changing dynamic.
Speaking of disruptors, by the way, do you have any thoughts on Elon Musk?
He's an interesting guy. You know, I had the great experience working at Tesla. I was there after we merged. I was in the Solar City for a few years.
Did you meet him?
I didn't meet him, no. You know, I think you need folks that are trying to look at things in a different angle and try to disrupt. And, you know, I think he's kind of an interesting figure with everything else that goes on publicly with him. But at the same time, like, you know, you want to make sure that we have, do have people innovating in this space, because what it does is it just changes everyone else's behavior to try and be the next big thing. I think the telecom industry and internet has been probably the best example of, you know, when you had some disruptors, like, you know, without Napster, you wouldn't have iTunes or Spotify. And you also wouldn't have just a changing realm of like how we can access information and share information online. And so, you know, we do need to make sure we have an economy that promotes that. And, you know, we need to highlight those folks in some ways.
It's one of those big changes. I've noticed that there's basically been one addition to the wardrobe over the last several decades, where you'd have your shirt, your pants, your wallet, maybe your keys, and that's been it. But then now everyone has an additional item. They have a cell phone on them at all times. And it's really changing things. So I think that's important to keep in mind when we plan the economy.
Adam Sandler recently did a rap about that.
Yeah, and you look at a good example of a nimble company that changed its business model to adjust to things is AT&T. You know, they were a landline company for decades. And then over time, as landlines became less popular and they had to diversify their business model, you know, now they're involved in programming and other things like that, where, you know, they're a cable provider, they provide internet, but they, you know, I don't want to toot their horn too much, but they are a good example of their core business model started to change. So they found different avenues to get engaged with and adjust. And I think there's a lot of fossil fuel companies and auto companies that can probably learn a lesson there especially as we see climate change really start to change things.
So I think Joe also wanted to talk about voting a little bit. And I wanted to ask one final question on the topic of running for Congress.
Yes.
Before we got into that. And this is actually kind of a softball one. I'm just kind of curious. Do you have any kind of like amusing stories or interesting or just kind of funny experiences on the campaign trail?
It had a few. I mean, it was my best memory of the campaign trail was I got engaged while I was running. So my fiance, she hadn't visited her sisters yet. And so for a few months, they live in New York. And so I kind of worked with my team to take a Sunday off and helped her plan her trip and then surprised her and proposed to her. I took a red eye to Brooklyn, met her family. They had told her it was like just a family photo shoot. We hadn't taken family pictures in a while, and then surprised her in a park in Brooklyn and proposed. And she said yes, obviously. And then, you know, spent the day with her and her family and then flew back the next morning to just get back on the campaign trail. She's amazing. And so that's, you know, for me, that's probably the most memorable experience of the campaign was while I was doing that whole crazy thing, I got engaged with a woman I love.
That's great. That's really wholesome.
Yeah. So yeah. It was, you know, and then there were just other experiences that were just like interesting and kind of weird. We had a guy, Ben Wexler, who does a lot of writing, comedy writing and TV writing, who'd approached and wanted help with just some creative ads to just, you know, help get my name out there. Because, you know, in this environment, if you're a candidate running, you're trying to find different ways to penetrate. And so he ended up doing an ad with his dog, Lulu, which was like a little terrier or something like that. And so we did a whole ad with Lulu talking about why she supports me. And then it ended up going viral for a few days, which is just kind of a nutty experience.
I can imagine.
And so tried to have just fun with different things where it was just like, you know, let's be creative and a little outside the box. We had a debate with Next Gen, and they had every candidate. They asked us to, at the end, talk about a different skill that we had that was unique and people wouldn't necessarily know about us. And I was kind of like, well, you know, it's catered towards a younger audience and these things can be kind of stuffy affairs. And again, you're trying to break out and, you know, kind of be engaging. And so, you know, other folks took a little more standard things of like prototypical hobbies. And I told folks that my hobby, and it was true at the time because we were always on the run, was having potato tacos from Taco Bell. And so I...
potato tacos?
Yes. So for my skill in that portion, I ate a taco. And then I also had my staff bring up a bunch of bags of tacos and I started tossing them out in the crowd.
Wait, your skill was eating the tacos?
Yes. My side hobby was like...
That's awesome.
You know, dude. And so just having fun with it a little bit. And we ended
up... Are you a vegetarian or do you just like them?
I like them.
Okay.
And so, you know, the whole time was trying to find different ways to communicate with people and, you know, make an impression in a very crowded field. And so we had a lot of fun with it. I think the dog ad and the tacos were probably more of the sillier things that we did.
Well, you need silly sometimes.
But yeah, you got to be silly. And also you got to be able to laugh at yourself and look back and be like, hey, we had some fun with that. The other kind of more random thing I did was the Nixon Library held a candidate forum. And they initially only invited the Republicans. And one of my supporters had reached out and said, why aren't you inviting the Democrats? And so then they, you know, you're a nonprofit, you have to do that. And so then they invited all the Democratic candidates, but it turned out I was the only one that said yes. And so I'm at the Nixon Library with a bunch of folks in the audience wearing their Make America Great Again hats. And, you know, it's a very red hat crowd and very riled up conservatives. And I was the only Democrat on stage. And so everyone was really gracious. We had a lot of fun with it. I did get booed a few times, but it was all like kind of good natured. But it was also, you know, and I told folks there it was an opportunity to make sure that we're talking to everyone in the district, and just philosophically, I wanted to make a contrast with where I felt Ed Royce hadn't been doing that. And that's why you had a lot of folks protesting and things like that, where if he'd made a little more outreach, I think, to the Democrats in this community, that might've been a little different. And so, you know, had a lot of fun with that though, because, you know, they had their talk radio hosts and they were like, what is this guy doing here? You know, I think it's important. And so always trying to find different ways to break through. That's the advice I've given to candidates after the fact who are still on the ballot and doing things. I'm like, you know, you got to be a little outside the box and find different ways, because if 1% of the brain of a person is focused on politics, which that's not the case with most folks, but let's say 1%, Donald Trump is occupying roughly 90% of that 1%, because, you know, he's such a loud figure. And so you're essentially competing for that last 10% with every other candidate, every other campaign, every other issue. And so you have to find different ways to penetrate. And so, you know, we tried to have fun with that a little bit during the primary.
We can circle back to that, by the way, when it comes to maybe some advice you might have for up and coming candidates or just people who are considering running. But I think we also kind of wanted to talk about the upcoming election and voting and Joe had a couple questions off the top of his head that he wanted to get into. So go ahead, Joe.
So climate change is real.
Yes.
More people are running than ever for office. Many propositions are on the table that affect taxes, healthcare, and other hot topics that people do care about, as we're seeing. What would you say, Sam, to speak to our listeners towards the importance or the value of voting?
Well, I think the big thing is politics can seem very, very distant, and it can seem just very disconnected from people's day-to-day lives. But the reality is it's a lot closer than what you think, and you have a lot more ability to change the nature of our politics if you get engaged. You know, using the example right now of what's going on with Congress, we have a huge election on Tuesday that's going to shape who our Congress looks like. And, you know, why is that important? Because it creates a little more balance in Washington, D.C. So you get a little bit more of both perspectives. If you're unhappy with the current administration, this is a chance to make sure there are some folks who can create some accountability. If you're happy with the current administration, you still want some diversity of opinions up there, because it will make your side better. And so, you know, I think there's one that is, you know, in California in particular, we've never had this type of a role in terms of determining the future of Congress, where it's literally going to be a few hundred, if not a few dozens of votes that are going to decide some of these congressional races. And so, you know, that's a lot of power and that's a lot of influence. And so just on that alone, from the like who's governing aspect, but more so, you know, I think it's, if you're not engaged and you're not voting, especially if you're on the younger side, your issues aren't going to be raised and discussed. And so that's how we get in a situation where, you know, we do have a student debt crisis and it's still not being resolved. Is this election going to fix that right away? No. But showing presence and showing that people are voting and paying attention is going to give a lot more influence to be able to go up there after the election and say, okay, well, now you guys need to start solving this problem and making sure we don't have an entire generation just saddled with debt. Or if you look at housing as an issue where it's really hard to buy a home or even consider buying a home at this point in California or anywhere in the U.S. if you're under 40, essentially. And so, what, you know, I think I saw the other day in San Francisco, you have to make $303,000 to be able to buy a home in the city. That's obviously not the normal income for most folks. And so, yeah. And so, you know, this is a chance to be able to show, hey, we're here too, and we're paying attention, and then use that to, you know, I think democracy is not just a matter of voting. It's a matter of also visiting and engaging with candidates and campaigns. It's kind of a full contact sport. You got to get in the full game there to make a difference. And so, you know, the first step is voting. And if we can get more folks to vote, that will just shape the people up there that we can push to make sure they're actually talking about and dealing with some of these issues.
And if there was ever a time to vote, it's now.
Yes. So totally.
Interestingly, yeah, speaking of which, by the way, I've noticed that this midterm election, perhaps unlike a lot of others, seems to be generating an actual lot of interest. And usually, not I'm not trying to say this offensively whatsoever, but the midterm elections tend to be kind of like the, oh, well, that's nice kind of stuff,
yeah,
where it's not really the quote unquote important ones. But the truth is they're extremely important. And I'm kind of inspired at the moment because I see just so much buzz about this year's elections. Do you think that that's the beginning of a new trend, or do you think this is an anomaly?
I hope so. And I think it's an anomaly if we just let this be a fleeting moment. A good example I'd give is the Supreme Court. The 2014 midterm elections was actually more important for this recent Supreme Court nomination than is we don't discuss it enough how important it was, because that was the election the Republicans solidified their majority. And what that did was allow them to block President Obama's Supreme Court nomination. And when Justice Scalia passed away. And so, you know, had even if Hillary had lost, Obama would have gotten that fifth justice, and maybe Trump wins and he would have had another opportunity there to shape the court a little bit. But we wouldn't have had seen, you know, him essentially get two justices in his first term. And that's only because of the fact that people functionally sat out the 2014 election. And so, you know, there's a lot of examples of what's going on today that wouldn't have happened had people paid attention in prior midterms. And so hopefully this isn't just a moment where we're saying a lot of folks are dissatisfied with the direction of the country. We're all going to vote because we want to stop this and have a check in D.C. and all that stuff. And it's more of, okay, we need to do that right now, but also moving forward, if we want to merely make sure that the government's really working for us, we're fully engaged in who all those positions are, because Congress plays such a huge role in this stuff. You know, if you support things like Medicare for All, it's not possible without being fully engaged in midterm elections, just because that shapes the nature of who both people, you know, the Democrats in there and the Republicans, and what kind of Democrats are in there. If you care about climate change, like, midterms are going to matter so much more, because like Congress is the one who does a lot of these things, not just the presidency. And so, you know, I'm hoping that this opens the door for people normalizing, okay, off-year elections are important right now. And then I'm going to keep paying attention because I want to make sure that this doesn't get away from us again.
I kind of think of the elections that happen every 4 years as the Mario, and the midterm elections is Luigi. They're both, the Mario brothers are both important, and we should probably pay attention to both of them. And I'm really hoping, like you are, that this is a trend in the right direction. And I will be voting in California, and I hope every listener, if you have had the chance, will either go ahead and vote or has already voted. I like to promote voting on this show. I don't know if you've looked into the show at all, but on every episode, I put a link to register to vote on there just to encourage that. I think it's interesting because if everyone who said, you know, well, I don't think my vote matters, if all of them voted, I think we'd see a very, very different outcome. So I always want to encourage people to vote. So go vote.
People don't only vote because they think their vote doesn't matter. Registering to vote takes work, as well as educating yourself.
Less work than you'd think, though.
It's less work than you think. Mm-hmm. I'd like to, and I'm not saying if you're not registered yet, it's too late to be registered to vote for this Tuesday, right?
Which means it's super important that you register now so you can vote in the next one.
And if you are registered already,
you can get a provisional ballot, by the way.
If you're registered already, do yourself a favor. If you're not educated on the issues, just go on Google for like 5 minutes, learn what is on the ballot, and just start to do some research. 5 minutes. Just do it right now. Just pull out your phone, go on Google, type in what's on the ballot. I don't even know. Sam, is there a better way to do it, to become educated? A lot of the viewers, they've only got 5 minutes. How can they become educated to vote in 5 minutes?
I think it's tough in that sense of like, you know, Google's the best way to do it. My fiance and I were going through our ballot today because we're going to vote early tomorrow. And you know, you just got to Google this stuff. League of Women Voters has a lot of great information about every candidate and every campaign, and even down to judges and recommendations there. The Democratic Party and Republican parties also list out their endorsements. I tend to think League of Women Voters is great because it's nonpartisan, so you're getting a little more just on the level, this is the facts. And that just takes a quick, you know, it takes 5 minutes, and you just scroll through and figure out, okay, who am I looking at? And maybe take a picture on your phone or take your phone in with you, because you can do that. And then, you know, it's not a challenging process, but it is a process that, like, you know, you got to be committed to doing it. And if you haven't registered to vote, or you moved and it's too late to register, call a few friends and make sure that they vote then. I think this is an important election where we need to make sure our friends and family are voting.
Yep.
Even if they're skeptical about things and saying, well, I don't know about this stuff. You know, the only way we fix this is by getting engaged.
My fiance's mom is voting for the first time because of...
That's awesome.
Because of everything that's going on in this election. So...
Yeah.
That's good. She's never been somebody who voted before, but she took the time to register, and she's finding out what her polling place is, and she's gonna vote.
By the way, I'd like to put a quick plug in for Ballotpedia. I find that somewhat helpful.
Yes,
it just kind of tends to organize the issues, and it gives the argument on both sides, and it'll let you decide for yourself.
Yeah, Ballotpedia is great. League of Women Voters is great. Even just like. A lot of newspapers, especially in California, we have these tough propositions. A lot of them do include summaries of the various propositions aside from their endorsements. And I think that helps a lot.
Also, it's not exactly related, but I think it's good to check is Snopes, just to check to see if things are factual or just made up. I think politically that's helped me a lot over the last few years to differentiate, you know, real news from fake news and actually get to the heart of the issues.
Yes.
I like to go on there.
Chris, you haven't really said anything this episode. Our listeners probably forgot you're on with us.
They forgot you
existed.
Is there
anything on your mind, Chris? Any questions you have for Sam or anything else?
Every time I have questions, you guys actually, within the next sentence or two, answer it. Like, I was going to ask where the best place to start to look for information would be. And then you guys, of course, answered that with Ballotpedia. And what was yours, Sam?
League of Women Voters.
League of Women. Okay.
So it sounds like you're kind of just mind melding with us and transmitting your questions through osmosis into our brains, and we're just asking them.
Because that's how osmosis works.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, that's
what osmosis is.
Yeah, that's
is.
Science.
Yeah. If you guys miss something, I'll let you know. I'll chime in.
Through osmosis.
Through osmosis. Yes. Before we get into a little bit more lighthearted to kind of cap things off, by the way, I have a question for you. And it's kind of a challenge. And feel free, by the way, as a politician and you know, someone who's in important positions, to say, no, I can't answer that, and we'll cut it. But I'm just curious. What is maybe even just one thing that you think the Democrats are doing wrong?
I think the Democrats need to focus on a lot more of the kitchen table issues that are like, and not just from like the catchphrase side of things, but kind of how I mentioned earlier, the cost of living. And looking at it from different generations' perspectives. Like, a lot of times this comes up when you're talking about prescription drug prices and Social Security and Medicare, which, you know, really tends to focus on the senior population. I think we're all concerned about making sure that young people turn out. You're going to get a cohort of young voters who are going to turn out because of issues like choice, LGBTQ rights, civil rights, or climate change. Those folks are going to vote. And, you know, you need to make sure to have messages there. But there's a lot of folks who may vote, but they have to be talked to, one, which we don't do enough of with younger voters. But two, you have to make elections relevant. And so a good example is, like, I was talking to someone about this with, you know, California's Proposition 10, which deals with rent control, which, you know, is solely within the purview of renters that they'd be concerned about that. And in an election where we really need to make sure that young people are turning out, to me, if, like, you know, hindsight's 2020, but I would have tried to really, like, pair up some of the outreach and engagement to young voters with a conversation on Prop 10. Because for a lot of young voters in particular, it's like, yeah, okay, great, I'm pro-choice. Great, you know, I'm pro-civil rights. Great, like, climate change has got to be dealt with. But I still might not vote because I have other stuff going on, or how is this relevant to my day-to-day life? And so tying it into those issues, I think, is critical, and I don't think the party does enough of that. I think on the student loan issue and student debt and just cost of education, it never comes up. It literally never comes up in discourses on the party side, which you'd figure, as a party very dependent on millennial voters, laser-like focused on an issue that affects everyone on a monthly basis. And so, you know, during the primary, I would say this stuff as well, that that's why we need new voices. We need young people engaged, because these issues just are not being discussed, and it becomes a lot harder to turn out voters if you're not discussing the things that actually affect them on a day-to-day basis.
It's a great answer to that question. I really appreciate you talking about that, especially at length.
Yeah.
Before we get to, I actually have one more, and this is just real quick. One more serious question. Of the politicians that are out there doing their thing right now, are there any of them that you'd like to potentially shout out as being inspirational to you in some way?
Well, I think, like everyone, I think what Beto O'Rourke's doing in Texas is pretty awesome. You know, with just exciting a lot of folks and really being direct contact with voters.
Joe and I are huge fans of him.
Yeah, I mean, I think what he's doing is cool stuff. I think what, we've...
One more time? I missed it.
Beto O'Rourke?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Love that guy. Great guy. I hope he wins.
Yeah.
Against the Zodiac Killer, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, and partially, you know, it's him or the Zodiac Killer, as Lars said.
Exactly. So, it's easy one choice. Those are some crazy options. And so I think, you know, what he's doing is hopefully a good roadmap of this is how you're going to engage folks. I'm good friends with Mike Levin, who's running down in South Orange County, North San Diego County. And Mike is really focused on the environment and clean energy issues. I think that's huge. It's helping, you know, these are issues that can be unifying for a lot of folks if you just talk about it in a different way. And he's doing that. I think Katie Porter, who's running in the Irvine area, super exciting with a lot of her focus on just middle class issues and a lot of those kind of kitchen table topics. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of really good folks that are running, a lot of good energy. Amar Campa-Nahar, he's running against Duncan Hunter, who's been indicted and is just this awful, awful guy. Amar, you know, he's running as an underdog in a very, very Republican district, but he's in it neck and neck. And I think it's inspiring because he's also, you know, a young candidate running against some strong headwinds and just putting the work in. And I've also met a lot of good local candidates that are just doing some cool stuff. And so, you know, there's been just, I think that's, again, kind of going back to what we talked about earlier, there's just a lot of really great energy that's been out there because people feel the need to step up and engage. And I think this is all going to be a good thing, regardless of what happens on Tuesday, because it's just up to the game of folks that have to be engaged.
I think that I just have so many more serious questions that I could ask, but you know, it's getting to the point where we've been recording for about an hour now, and I just want to make sure that we don't, you know, spend too much of our listeners' time. And I think we can go ahead and cap the episode with maybe a couple less serious questions just to kind of wind things down, if you're interested, Joe.
Yeah, I think that we covered what we wanted to cover, and
I have, you know, a good dozen more things I'd potentially want to ask, but it's starting to get pretty late, and want to respect everyone's time. We have a tradition on this show of asking some pretty lighthearted hypothetical questions, and the two big ones we've been tending to ask guests. Joe, do you want to toss one of them out?
Which one did you have in mind?
The delivery one.
So, Sam, if somebody, some guy just shows up to your door and basically leaves you 20,000 tons of Nutella and says, you know, this is yours now, do whatever you want with it, and leaves. What are you most likely to do with your new batch?
Yeah, what would you do with it if it just showed up at your door?
20,000 tons of Nutella.
Yep.
20,000 tons of Nutella. I think my fiance is vegan, and so we have a pretty vegan household. Sure. So I wouldn't dive into the Nutella myself. I guess
it's a lot.
You know, that's 20, a lot. I'd look and see from like just like the economic side of it, being like, yeah, well, are there distributors that I can maybe sell some of this to? And then I'd also look and see, are there like shelters that maybe we can donate some of this to, since it did come for free? And seeing if, you know, that's helpful to folks as well. Cause you know, I guess I try to, you know, see if we
Let's
can
you
make
give
an investment
out
while
all
at the same
the
time
Nutella
giving something
you can,
back.
You sell everything you can, and you've still got half of it left. what are some other things that you would do with Nutella? Like, let's say you could snap your fingers and fill up a swimming pool. Would you want to go swimming in a silly swimming pool of Nutella? Or do you think that would be more like a quicksand? Do you think that would be more like a quicksand kind of situation?
I think it'd be more like a quicksand situation, actually.
Yeah, that would be untimely demise, I think, for Sam. I don't think he should do that.
But it would be, like, you know, maybe if it's more, like, in, like, a jacuzzi or something, then you're not going to just completely drown.
Hell, a jacuzzi.
And just be able to say, we have, like, a jacuzzi of Nutella there. I'd probably try to throw a few parties where...
Nutella parties,
Nutella themed, I guess. You know,
that's like awesome. Just it's like, the main here, entree take for this. Folks. I have too much.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and toss to you the last one, and then we can kind of wrap things up. So let's say that some person on the street approaches you, and they're like an accredited scientist who can do this. So it's like it will work.
Yeah.
They offer you $2 billion right on the spot. Just, you'll get it tax-free. It's available to you immediately. But in exchange, you have to spend the next 4,300 years as a duck. Would you do it?
Wait, can you repeat that?
So basically, you have to become a duck for 4,300 years. And then you go right back to this moment and you get $2 billion.
I know what you're thinking. A duck doesn't live 4,300 years. So you're a duck, right. You die, you're a duck again.
Yeah, so you just keep coming back as ducks. A duck.
A series of ducks.
To get $2 billion.
Yeah.
No time is lost, nothing, no consequence to you, but you have to spend 4,300 years as a bunch of ducks.
So, like, would you come back to life in the same moment in time? Or
just like it's November 3rd. Like, if it happened right now, it's November 3rd at 11:47 p.m., and then the scientist gives you the $2 billion, let's say, and the very next moment, you're a duck for 4,300 years, and then it ends, and now it's back to November 3rd at 11:47 p.m.
I think I would do it in that case.
I think I would, too.
Now, part two... would you want to keep your memories as a duck? Or would you want to forget about all that happened?
Yeah, would you want to retain your duck wisdom?
Your duck wisdom?
I think I'd want to retain the duck wisdom.
Why?
Yeah. It could be useful on the campaign trail in the future.
Can you speak more to that, Sam?
It could be just a different appreciation of nature. Maybe in my duck experiences, I saw the world. Mm-hmm. And so just... you know, it was able to observe a lot that I'd want to be able to. Yeah, from a bird's eye view, exactly.
Maybe Congress has some duck issues they're ignoring. I don't know.
Like, yeah.
Congress is not in touch with ducks.
Out of touch with ducks.
Come back, and your whole unfortunately. Campaign will be revolving around the ducks.
Yeah.
Why is this guy? He's a smart guy, but why is everything about ducks?
Yeah. Why does every issue keep focusing on like different lake issues?
He just spent 4,300 years as a duck, so that's why.
The D in his name doesn't stand for Democrat. It stands for duck.
Yes.
The duck candidate.
I think it would be more of like, what's his obsession with like small pieces of bread at a time or like different increments.
Oh, yeah. You think you'd take on the habits of the ducks at that point. Oh, boy. Wow. This got amusing at the end.
This is
yeah.
good. This is good. Should we do one more like useless superpowers or something?
Sam, do you have time?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
That's a quick
Joe,
one.
Throw it at him.
So the question goes like this. You can choose any useless superpower that you want. So a useless superpower is basically a superpower that goes beyond the realm of normalcy of what a human is normally capable of. However, it's not allowed to benefit you in any significant way. It can benefit you in insignificant ways or not at all.
Let me give you an example. Like the ability to instantly go bald. Like, it's just stuff that doesn't help.
Stuff that doesn't help at all. There's just like literally like I'm stuck with this superpower.
Yeah, like the ability,
you don't even
to,
want to use it.
Here's one that's marginally useful: the ability to dispense any condiment you want out of your index finger. So it's useful.
Yeah, it'll help you a little bit.
You go get a hot dog at a place.
You don't have to get a ketchup packet.
They're out of ketchup. Yeah. You can still have ketchup. No one else can have it. You can have it. when maybe you offer to other people, hey, they're out of ketchup, but I can get you some ketchup.
They look at you kind
of
weird.
What are you talking about? Like, I can make ketchup come out of my finger, and you show them, and they're like, ah! Because it looks like you're just...
That kind of stuff, basically.
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
Any useless superpower.
Useless superpower. See, I'm trying to get myself not thinking like the second tier useful of like, my car will automatically parallel park for me or something like that.
Oh, that's super useful. That's cheating.
That's a superpower right there.
That is a genuine superpower.
That's a genuine useful superpower.
I will give it to you though. Some of our guests have said things like the ability to fly. Like, no, you don't get the ability to fly as your useless superpower.
That's not useless.
That's a superpower. That's a great superpower. Top five superpower.
No, but I have a good, I'll give you one if you want it that's related to that. How about the ability to automatically parallel park, but not very well?
Always
it's
requires
kind of like you do a poor job.
I think a better on top of that would be parallel park other people's cars.
Parallel park other people, but not you?
Yeah.
Or they,
so I couldn't, from it all, but like my friends knew that if they were in a bind.
Yeah, you could help them. It's just, it doesn't work for me.
Yeah.
When I was starting out driving, I was having some issues parking. I had this big, long Mercury Villager, and this one middle-aged dude came up and he was like, do you want me to do it for you? And then we almost had him do it. And then my brother was like, do you have insurance? And then he got insulted and he walked off.
Did you ask him if he had the superpower?
I didn't know about the superpower yet.
Yeah, it's possible that was his power. Yeah,
what about the ability during rush hour traffic to speed up traffic for everyone else?
Like your lane stays.
Oh, it doesn't help you at all.
No, but it's
every lane you go in slows down, but everyone else gets the truth.
It's utilitarian because it helps everyone else but you.
I kind of feel like I have that power, by the way. Like whenever I change lanes, it seems like it immediately slows down. So, yeah, I think I have that one. Anyway, we've been going for about an hour and 20 now. We'll probably edit down to about an hour, but I think that's probably good if you guys want to cap it.
Yeah, sure.
Hey, yeah, Sam, thank you for playing along with some of the goofier questions, and also thank you for going into detail about some of the more serious stuff. This was a very informative and interesting discussion. I'm blessed to have you on.
Wonderful. No, thank you guys for having me. I had a lot of fun. Really appreciate it.
Glad to
hear someone
that.
Wanted to find you out on the internet, out on social media and such, what would be the best way to do that?
So my Twitter is at Sam Jamal, SamJammal.
Okay. Is that your main platform?
That's my main platform. And then I'm on Facebook as well. We adjusted the page, but I had my old congressional page, but I think if you just search Sam Jamal, I can message you guys.
Oh, sure. Yeah. We'll go ahead and add your links to the description when we release the episode. And also, want to make sure we get your MySpace. Do you have your URL handy for that?
I don't have that anymore. Unfortunately.
That's a big one.
I know.
We'll
just bounce back to, Friendster. What's your Friendster?
So I never got on Friendster. I was on MySpace and then just lost that password. Friendster.
Do you have FreeWebs?
No, that's Chris.
I don't even know what that one is.
Oh, yeah, don't worry about that. Joe's just trying to make a joke. And
what's your Earthlink?
Oh, my. Okay.
You know, running for office and talking to a lot of donors and stuff like that who tend to run a little older, you realize the large number of people who have Earthlink and AOL email accounts and like Comcast and like some the other ones that like just aren't as common anymore. It's a little incredible. Like there's still, I didn't even realize Earthlink still existed, but there are a lot of people out there with Earthlink emails.
You can get internet through them at about like 0.1 megabits.
Yeah, did you know that AOL still does dial up? Like to this day, you can still get dial up from them.
Where else do you get your dial up from?
Exactly. Nowhere.
Because it doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
They're going for that less than 1% market share.
There's a certain percentage.
I don't want to change.
There's a certain percentage of the population that still wants to have dial-up. They don't care if DLS is cheaper.
DLS.
DLS. Yeah.
DSL.
Well, It's debatable.
Well, it's not.
Well,
it's debatable. Anyway. Right. Okay. Anyway. This has been an increasingly amusing but always interesting episode of the First Podcast. My name is Lars. I'm your main host and editor. And with me, as always, is the intern, Joe.
Hey, thanks for joining us.
And my co-host, Ohan, who's not here.
Ohan.
And the guest liaison, who had about three words this entire episode, Chris.
This will be my fourth. Good to be on.
Oh, I think that was
fifth, sixth, and seventh.
Yeah, about eight words. Great.
And
we're improving.
Kirsten's been on, but she decided not to say anything this time.
Yeah, again. She's been on since episode one, but she's been quiet lately. And last time, this has been Sam Jamal, your friend from the 39th District. He ran in the primary election, and who knows, maybe he will run again someday. I have no idea. This is just speculation entirely, but go ahead and sign us off, Sam.
Thank you. I don't know if that's in the works at all at this point, but enjoy the opportunity and experience.
Yeah, and if you're interested in following us on any social media platform, be it Spotify, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Apple Podcasts, you can find all that information and more at Linktree. The URL is linktr.ee/thefirstpodcast. One more time, that's linktr.ee/thefirstpodcast. That's Linktree, First Podcast. Linktree. Anyway, that was our Linktree. If you're interested in contributing to our Patreon, that URL is patreon.com/firstpodcastever. And any contributions you make to the Patreon just go towards supporting a better production for the show. You know, mics, studios, stuff like that.
All right, I'm going to head on out and see you guys later.
Remember to get out and vote.
Please vote, guys.
Please, please vote.
Yeah.
Please.
Well, you don't have to say it like that.
I'm begging you.
Please don't say it like that. Just...